Hi, and welcome to today's meeting of Book Hoarders Anonymous. Let's all begin by introducing ourselves.
Hi, I'm Shannon, and I'm a book hoarder.
Hi, Shannon.
Hi, I'm Erin, and I'm a book hoarder.
Hi, Erin.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Book Hoarders. This is episode number, I'm losing count, 24?
24, I think that's right.
Woohoo! This is Erin.
And this is Shannon.
And we are here to talk about Elisa Lorello's book, Adulation. But before we get to any of that, we have all sorts of other things to talk about, including two listener mails.
Two listener mails.
We were whining and complaining a couple months ago because we didn't get any. Now we have two. The first listener mail we have is from Jenna, who is listening to our podcast. And she actually discovered us last summer, Jenna Moffitt. And she is still listening. She had a couple of book recommendations that she has sent to us. And we really do appreciate that. Thank you very much for that. And we will certainly consider all of the recommendations that everyone sends to us. And also, another listener, we have Lewis, who just discovered our podcast, podcast number 23, he says. He will continue to tune in, and he also has shared some of his favorite books with us. some of his favorite books include The King Killer Chronicles by Patrick Rothfuss, which I have heard of before, and the Nick Heller series by Joseph Finder, which is, I guess, a spy series. Spies and espionage. Nick is a gentleman spy detective, Lewis says. And the Iron Druid Chronicles by Kevin Hearn, which I have heard of, and some of these are on Bard, actually. They just started putting those up, I guess, within the past several months. And those are fun to read. I think I've read, like, one, and it's one of those that I keep meaning to go back to and keep not. And another series by Nelson DeMille about a John Corey, who is, I guess, an NYPD detective. So lots of nice spy and fantasy stuff from Lewis, that some of which I haven't read. So I'm looking forward to checking out some of that. And thanks, as always, for to all the listeners who tune in and who send us such wonderful book recommendations. And that takes us into our reads for the month. So, Shannon, what have you read this month?
Okay. I'm going to keep this pretty short because we got lots to cover this month. So, I read a fair bit of stuff. I was sick and on vacation, so that sort of cut into reading as much as I'd like, but I still did okay. The couple of things I wanted to mention, I read the first book in Yasmin Gallinoran's Otherworld series. It's called Witchling, and it's urban fantasy, and it's very light urban fantasy. It's not super dark. I gather that the series gets a little darker as it goes along, but the first book was fairly, not fluffy exactly, but not, it was a good airplane ride book, which is what I read it on. And then the other one that I really thought was interesting, I read it during my, when I was recovering from the cold that I got after my trip. I read Mary Roach's Gulp, Adventures on the Elementary Canal. And if you haven't read Mary Roach,
I've been wanting to read that book for a while.
Yes. It was very interesting. If you haven't read Mary Roach, she writes, very accessible nonfiction about bizarre topics. the other one I read was, I read a couple of them. I read Bonk, which was her book about sex.
Woo!
And I read Packing for Mars, which is more about like what it would actually take to be a like if you want, if like a colonist on Mars. And so she's got, it's kind of a little wacky. Like she gets into these topics, and this one was about food and like basically how our digestive system works.
Oh yay, I need that one.
Right. It'll make you never want to eat again.
Oh god.
But you know, it's super, like she's not going for the gross out so much as just like this is this really bizarre thing. Like I'm trying to think of examples, but they she was talking with how some people like there is such a thing as fecal transplants.
Ew. That doesn't even sound
right. But it like, and it legitimately has health benefits. Not that you really want to do it. And she like went and like watched one of these being done.
God. So what kind of health benefits could that possibly have?
I think it's something to do with it's something to do with like if you have some kind of infection.
Ooh.
But I can't remember because I got stuck on fecal transplants. But it was really fascinating.
Wow.
And then I won't end it there because that's not a good place to end it.
No, it really isn't.
Right now I'm reading I never read these as a kid, but the Susan Cooper Dark is Rising books. I started the first one the other day, and I'm still not quite done with it. It's called It's Over Sea Under Stone, and then The Dark is Rising is the next one, and it's kind of like it's working for me. I didn't know if it would, because sometimes children's books don't age well, you know. and this one kind of doesn't age well in a few areas. It was definitely written in the 60s, and you could tell.
Mm-hmm.
And there's like, you know, it sort of bothers me that the one female character is just sort of there. Like, yeah. She doesn't get to, she gets to have adventures, but she's always the one that's like, oh,
come and help me.
We shouldn't be doing this. Mm. We're going to get in so much trouble.
Mm-hmm.
but it's fun. So that's what I've been reading.
Okay. Well, that's cool. I actually have been reading some nonfiction this month. Go me!
Woohoo!
I've been wanting to... I stumbled across this book on my iPhone, and in my quest to read all of the books on my iPhone, because I'm trying to get my iPad mini to be mostly my reading device.
Mm-hmm.
And to have my phone for like if I'm at work and want to read something at lunch or something, you know, like my secondary reading device. So I'm trying to read all the things that are on it. And one of these things happened to be this book that's been on there since like last October. And it's like one of these self-help kind of like womanly, like being assertive type books. I don't even know why I downloaded it. I guess I was going through a phase wanting to read these books, thinking they might be interesting and like downloading a whole bunch of stuff and then not reading it. This book, though, it's really good. It's called Smart Cookies Don't Crumble, The Smart Woman's Guide to Living and Loving Her Own Life by Sonia Friedman, who is actually a pretty well-known like psychiatrist and therapist for women who's been around since like the 80s. Like, and this book is sort of dated. I mean, it's from the 1980s. But a lot of the women in the book have the same sort of concerns that we have as women in the 2000s. So, you know, it's kind of in some spots a little bit dated, but in some spots not. It's pretty short. It's only about 6 hours long, 5 hours maybe even. So and very accessible. And she just basically talks about, you know, being a what's involved in being sort of a. Well, you know, a woman who is, you know, assertive and yet, you know, has basically a good, well-rounded life. You know, what does it take mm-hmm. for you might not be what it takes for, you know, Jane Smith down the street. So, you know, you know, talking about things that maybe some women have trouble with, like the ability to say no. I really related to that chapter, you know, and how that's okay. You know, saying no is like an okay thing. There's a whole chapter on it because I guess a lot of women, including myself, have trouble with it. You know, kind of like balancing all the different things that we as women have to do, careers and families and, you know, husbands in some cases and things like that. And she's not out to say that men are evil. There are, like, you know, a lot of women who are married to a lot of, you know, very nice men in this book. So it's not a book that touts men as as evil people, which I appreciated.
Mm-hmm.
One of my gripes with a lot of feminist writing and certainly a lot of feminist thought that I was exposed to when I was in college is that a lot of feminists that I had to read were over quick to dismiss men in general as,
mm-hmm.
well, I don't want to say the word evil because that's really not the word I'm looking for, but, you know.
Right.
All men are insensitive and don't understand women, sure. and, you know, all that kind of thing. And this book does not do that. And so I appreciated that very much. It took me a while to finish it because I was reading it on my lunch break and kind of like before work. So it was like 15 minutes here, 15 minutes there. But it was one of those books you could pick up and then put back down. And it has a lot of good insights in it. And so I feel like it's something that I will come back to, not as a comfort read, but as sort of like a, what should I do here read? It's mm-hmm. not like, you know, ooh, this is the gospel or anything like that. But it was really insightful and accessible and easy to read. And so I'm glad that I found it. The next book that I want to talk about is called What is Visible by Kimberly Elkins. And it's really nagging me because I feel like I know this author from somewhere, but I can't think where. This is her first novel, though. And it seems like, based on other work that I have read about the people that it's about, that it was pretty historically accurate. It's fiction. It's historical fiction. It's about Laura Bridgman, Samuel Howe, and Julia Ward Howe, and Sarah Swift. And all these people were at the Perkins Institute for the Blind at one point. And it's really mostly about Laura Bridgman's life, who at one point was one of Perkins' poster children, if you want to call it that. Mm-hmm. She was the first deaf-blind child to be educated at Perkins in the 1830s, and actually lived at Perkins most of her life. And I read a nonfiction book about her a couple of years ago and talked about it on Book Hoarders. It was one of the first episodes we had, I think. I thought that it would be good to read something fictional that was not for children, because the only other fictional thing about her that I read was a kid's book.
Right.
And this was definitely for adults. This was not a kid's book. And it was basically about her life as the author imagined it would be. There was some romance in it. Again, not for kids. Basically I thought, you know, I felt that it was, I mean, the author did her research and, from the, like afterword that she has in there, it sounds like she did a lot of research. And was privileged to be able to read some of Samuel Howe's diaries, which really I thought was kind of interesting because I don't think many people have been able to. He was such an ass. Anyway, you don't have to be a nice person to be a philanthropist, I guess. For being, you know, touting all of the, you know, people are free and things, he had some very unenlightened views about the place of women in the household, when I'm thinking about his wife, and also about, Laura at Perkins. He was very, she didn't have a whole lot of freedom and a whole lot of say in what she could and could not do or where she could and could not go. I mean, like getting a visit home to her parents, it was like pulling teeth. And I've read that in a variety of sources. Like, you know, he had these students under his thumb and her when she was older and grown and wanted to keep them there. And Julia Ward Howe, who, of course, was his wife and wrote the Battle Hymn of the Republic, which not a lot of people remember or know, there was a big to-do about that, which I remember reading somewhere else, and it also came out in the book, that she, you know, only got $5 for it, and he was very upset that she made money off of that. You know, being, it was the 1860s, and he was a very, very typical man in a lot of ways, although he, you know, thought of himself as a Unitarian and very enlightened. He had some serious shortcomings where women were concerned. So it was very interesting to read all about all these people. And they definitely had their flaws and were very human people. Sometimes you just wanted to shake them and go, But I really did enjoy the book, especially since all the people have interested me over the years. And let's see, my other book that I will mention very briefly, the fantasy that I... Oh, no, I won't mention the fantasy. The mystery that I started. I've started a new mystery series by Nevada Barr, who is a park ranger, I guess in her spare time, and she's also an author. And this series is about a park ranger named Anna Pigeon. And the first book is called A Superior Death. Again, I'm reading the books on my iPhone, and this had been there for ages and ages, and I just hadn't read it. And I loved the descriptions of the natural scenery. And so each book takes place in a different part of the country, in a different national park, I guess. And this one is like somewhere on Lake Superior. I don't remember what park, or if these parks are even real. I'm not really sure. I think some of them are, that she bases her books in. And they're all like mysteries, like a park ranger gets killed or something happens. And so, you know, Anna Pigeon, again, with all of her past baggage that we find out about as I guess we read the series, tries to solve these mysteries. And the first book, the descriptions of the natural scenery were just wonderful. And I thought, wow, I hope this is a trend. And so I started the second, which takes place in the Arizona desert, in the Anasazi ruins out there in Colorado and Arizona, I guess. And it's equally as beautiful. So I'd encourage any mystery lover to check out that series, especially if you like a good dose of nature thrown in. And so those are my books for the month that I wanted to mention.
Okay. So we're not doing news this month because
we have other
stuff going on
that we'll get to, we promise. But we do want to talk about the book that we read. Or no, yeah, the book that we read.
Yes, we do.
Uh-huh. Adulation by Elisa Lorello. This book, it was definitely not one of her best books. I say this as a person who's read several of them. But it was the one that was on Bard. And so it was the one that we picked.
So it's the one we picked.
Yeah. And so let's talk with Shannon first, since I've done a whole bunch of talking. And I kind of have an idea about what you're going to say about the book. So let's hear what you've got to say first.
Okay. Well, Elisa Lorello, this is the point in the podcast, if you're listening, that you might want to go and have a nice, calming adult beverage. And you can come back in about 5 minutes, okay? I'll give you a minute. All right. I hated it. Did not like this book at all. Like, most of the books we read for the podcast generally work for me. I feel like the number of books that we've read that really haven't, I can name them off the top of my head. They are Under the Dome and Adulation. So... Elisa Lorello joined Stephen King, apparently. I am glad to know that her other books are not as like obnoxious, but this was pretty obnoxious. Mostly, I really struggled with believability. Was really, I didn't believe in what was going on. I kind of felt like the characters were. Like, okay, if you didn't read this book, we meet Sunny Masters, who is a bookstore stock manager, and she's really, really hung up on, like, enjoys the screenwriting of, or no, Sunny Smith is her name. Danny Masters is the
Danny
guy.
Masters is the guy, and yeah. Sunny Smith is the girl.
Yeah. So she's really hung up on Danny Masters' screenwriting, and, like, even to the point where she's, like, on a discussion group online for fans of his, and then like her friends are like, you know, hey, you're turning 40, these are the 40 things you should do, and they make a list for her, and one of them is sleep with Danny Masters. And then throughout the whole book, like, they act like this is a perfectly reasonable thing that she should be expected that she could totally do. And, you know, like, Danny Masters is not like some guy that's like down the street that she's gonna see at the grocery store every day. He's like this famous Hollywood screenwriter, and it's just like. And they meet for 5 minutes, and it's a very memorable meeting. And then they spend the rest of the book apart until the very, very end when they get back together. And then it's like, ah, oh, true love. And, and, like, And then, like, there's this cheesy epilogue at the end that's like a screenplay of their
married,
like,
life,
cheesy happy married life. And so, like, as somebody who reads a lot of romance, which is what this is, what NLS marketed this as, like, it's not. It does not fit my definition of a romance, because, like, the characters do not spend any time together. Like, the author is expecting me to buy that they're going to end up together and happily ever after, because, like, they both have this idea of what the other person is like in their heads from, like, these brief glimpses, and I just don't buy it at all. It was also really bothered me that they both needed people to spend time telling them, no, you really are awesome. And it felt like that was happening every chapter. There would be the, like, oh no, you're awesome conversation. And, like, you know, sometimes we totally need our friends to say that to us, but it was just a little too, like, navel gazy and, like, you know, oh, this is my past and what am I doing with my life? And they both kind of, like, circled around that question the whole entire time. And I just wanted, like, somebody to decide on something. And it just didn't work for me at all.
Well, I felt like, I guess I didn't really, I was bothered by the fact that they didn't meet until the very end. I was like, come on, meet already. But I did feel like it went on a little bit longer than it needed to. The whole, like, what am I doing with my life kind of thing. I felt like in some ways that was central to the book, but it went on a little longer than it needed to. And also, I did feel, though, that they finally figured out what they were meant to do, and that eventually they didn't need all these people telling them they were awesome anymore. But it took a little longer than I really felt comfortable with.
By the time they finally got there, I felt like they lost me.
Yeah, I can understand how it would have felt that way. I think one thing that helped me was that I didn't sit and read it all in one sitting. I kind of, like, got up, went, did other things, read it over a period of several days, and read other things in the middle. So I didn't feel like I was, you know, constantly being bombarded with, oh, you're so awesome and wonderful. You know, and constantly being told that. I was a little bit bothered by the fact that a couple of the characters in the book, I'm like, what is the purpose of this one character in particular? Sunny has these two friends, one of whom, why is this person even in the book? The chiropractor. It was kind of like she has no color. There's nothing to her in the book.
Oh, and I just have to say that, like, it really cracked me up that her other friend is the stereotypical sassy gay man. And she makes a point of being like, he's not a stereotypical sassy gay man, and we really hate it when we're compared to Will and Grace. But then, like, he spends the rest of the book being a sassy gay man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
With you know, a few minor asides of, you're awesome, Sonny. And then, like, they fight. But, you know, when they're not fighting, he's totally being that guy.
Oh, yeah.
And you can't just be like, he's not that way, and then proceed to go around and...
Half the time, though, when if you think about it, when people believe that people are not acting in a stereotypical way, they really are.
That's
so
true.
You know, really, when you... You know, a lot of times when people say, oh, we're not doing this or we're not doing that, they really are. So that didn't really bother me all that much. I think what bothered me was the fact that, you know, one of her friends... I mean, if you're going to be in the book, give the person a little bit of a definition.
Something to do, as far
as, you know, a kind of a character. And overall, I mean, I did not... This was not, you know, one of her better books. And I think that... Possibly one thing that helped me along is that I just threw the NLS categorization out the window when I was reading the book. And I said, I'm not going to get hung up on the fact that NLS considers this a romance, because I don't. And, you know, I'm not thinking of it as a romance. I'm thinking of this as like some, you know, this is just fiction. I'm not going to put, you know, I'm not going to try and categorize it as a romance when really it's not. You know, clearly they're involved with other people. Maybe they'll get together in the end. Maybe they won't. Probably they will, because, you know, that's the way these books work.
Yeah, that's how this thing is going.
But,
yeah.
I mean, that's how this thing is going. But when I think of romance, and when I, you know, when I think of romance, I think, like you do, that people are going to spend some time together. So I think NLS, you know, kind of like missed the bucket on this one. They do have a category called women's fiction, and I don't know why they didn't just stick it in there, because that's where I would have put it.
Yeah, it would have
gone
definitely like
better there.
A slightly older chick lit.
Yeah. I think it would have been better there, but anyway, why NLS does that, I don't know.
Yeah.
So anyway, that was kind of my take on it. I enjoyed it not as much as some of her other stuff. And I thought that the narrator, everyone loves Brené Rodman, just as an aside. I really don't. Maybe I'm a minority. She's okay, but she's not like one of my favorites. I did not enjoy her in this book.
She has read books. Her narration has been better in other things I've read. Her narration really bothered me, because it was like she was trying to do the Long Island accent, and I think that I would have really liked it if she had let that one go.
Yeah.
And also, like, I really hate it when narrators overact. And there mm-hmm. were times that she definitely literally whispering when there's whispering, and like having this itch in her voice when she's crying.
Oh,
and it just
dear.
Makes me so rolling my eyes.
Oh no. Yes. Yeah, I know. That gets to me too. And then
when you have the crying and the bad New York accent.
Oh my god. Oh, yeah, I know that was a little much, and that's one of the reasons why I had to abandon another book that I was reading this month, because a person that I really like narrating in general, although I like her books too, but she's a really good narrator, except when she does Southern accents. Her Southern accents were too distracting; I couldn't take it. And her children, she makes her voice like really high when she does kids. Mary Robinette Kowal. And she has like this really like lovely mellifluous voice when she's herself, but when she tries to do kids, it's like this little bitty voice, and it sounds like this, and it's really 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 weird. And then her Southern accents are just bizarre. I can't even imitate it. And so the whole book takes place in the South, and so everyone, she gives this real fake sounding Southern accent. I couldn't take it. I had to stop. So there's our crack on narrators for the episode.
Yeah.
And why don't we just move on from there, and you can mention our next book, since you're the one who picked it.
The book we're reading is This House of Sky by Ivan Doig. He is from Montana, and it's about him growing up in Montana, I think, like during the very beginning of the 20th century, and kind of like it seems like it's a very like you were talking about earlier with the Nevada Bar books, like mm-hmm. very atmospheric and lots of descriptions of the natural scenery and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always wanted to read one of his books, because he's very popular among our patrons here on the West Coast,
okay.
or in the Pacific Northwest.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, every time any new book of his comes out, it gets snatched up right away. So I'm really curious about him as an author. And my colleague over at the library was like, this is the best book. You should start with this book. And this is what you should read instead of whatever it was we were going to read. So, Alan, I don't know that you're listening, but, you know, we're taking your advice. And if we hate it, it's going to be your fault.
It's his fault. Alrighty then. Well, I guess we should, after introducing that, move on to the other stuff we have planned. The other stuff we have planned is a big surprise for our listeners. We have here an interview with Elisa Lorello, talking all about adulation and all about her writing career and all kinds of stuff. And this interview was conducted a couple of weeks ago by me with her, and it was really fun. So we are going to give it to you in its entirety, because it was so much fun that We couldn't think of anything else to cut out of it.
Yeah, we couldn't cut anything.
And so we hope you enjoy it. We'll just give our contact information right now and wrap this up. And encourage you all to listen to the interview that's coming up. If you want to get in touch with me, of course, it's Erin Edgar on Twitter.
My Twitter is at Bardsong. And if you want to follow the podcast on Twitter, it's at Book Hoarders.
Yes. And if you want to follow Shannon's blog of musings on Twitter, it's flightintofantasy.com. And you can also follow it on Twitter because she posts her blog postings come up on Twitter.
Multiple times because I haven't deleted that other plugin. But
yeah, well, that happens.
And then if you want to listen to some awesome internet radio, thephoenix.net. 6 to 9 Eastern on Sundays, it's The Melting Pot. That's Erin's internet radio show. It's very awesome.
Aw. And so check us out in our other pursuits. And
and if you want to send us an email like Jenna did and like Lewis did, you can, which you should.
Absolutely.
It's bhapodcast@gmail.com.
And if you want to make a comment on our blog, you can do that too. It's bhapodcast.com.
And now that our brains are completely fried from all the fireworks that have been going on after we recorded this.
Crash, boom, bang.
Yes, crash, boom, bang. They're totally fried. Yeah.
Yeah, there you go.
we need to do a gag reel, apparently. we will say goodbye.
Bye, everyone. See you next time. So I'm here today talking with Elisa Lorello about her book, Adulation, and about the craft of writing in general. Elisa, thank you so much for joining me. We really appreciate you taking the time out of your very busy schedule to do this for us.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. So who is your, I guess, intended audience, and why should they read your books?
That's a great question, and the answer is I don't necessarily have one. I don't write with an audience in mind, or when I do, I write with just one reader in mind. I don't think about a mass of people or a specific demographic of people. There's usually one person that I'm thinking about as I'm writing. And it's not always the same person, but it is usually one person. I don't start thinking about more than one until I'm in the revision stage. But always myself. I have to love what I'm reading. I have to want to go back to it. And because I do, I actually reread my books once they're published. I don't just put them on a shelf because that's why I wrote them. I wrote them because I wanted to read them. As far as in terms of, I guess, marketing or a targeted audience, I think my audience is predominantly women. Predominantly women my age, which is 40 something, or I would say probably between 30 and 50, is probably the wide range. I do have a male audience as well, which kind of surprised me in the beginning because I didn't think what I was writing was really particularly of interest to a male audience. But I'm glad to see that they've responded to it.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, so that's I think that is mostly who's reading it. But like I said, when I'm writing, I'm really thinking about one person, and it's either myself or it's somebody else that I'm envisioning at that moment.
Right. So let's talk about writing a little bit in general then. And you're saying you didn't think men would be interested in the type of books that you write. So for those who may not know and those who are new to this podcast, so what is the genre that you primarily write in?
Again, I'm going to say with what I'm being marketed. when I talk about genre, I say it's commercial fiction. In other words, it's not literary, so to speak. It's a more commercially marketable kind of novel. It's marketed as women's fiction. The more I'm doing this, I grow displeased with that particular label of a genre, because we don't have a genre called men's fiction. I think it should just be general fiction. And I think it's one of the reasons why I probably don't have a bigger male audience, because it's already been decided that it's for women. And I think, you know, there's a stigma attached to that men don't want to go there. It's also been occasionally marketed as romance, but in terms of the characteristics of very traditional romance novels, mine really don't fall into that category. I have love stories, and there is a romance that typically happens within the story, but it's not as far as what the characteristics of that genre are. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't call it a romance novel, per se. Mm-hmm. So I really just say it's general fiction. Mm-hmm. Which, again, people don't like because it's too broad.
Right. So how would you say your books differ from traditional romance novels or books or stories or whatever?
I'm forgetting the distinct characteristics. The entire story is usually focused on that one relationship. That one love story in general, whereas there are other characteristics. I'm horrible at explaining the genre. I always have to look it up and read from it. There are other things in terms of the character arc, and sometimes it's kind of like a star-crossed lovers thing, or they have to overcome an obstacle in order to be together and that sort of thing. And really, that's just about any story is going to have the main character is going to have some kind of obstacle. Mm-hmm. My characters and my stories, there are multiple relationships they're dealing with. So it's not just that one particular romance. They're dealing with relationships with their friends, with their families, with their coworkers. So it's a little bit more broad, and their main, whatever it is they want and whatever's in the way of their getting it, is not necessarily a relationship. It may be something else specifically. Sure. That they want. Mm-hmm. Or in While of Singlehood, she was determined not to be in a relationship, and then all of a sudden she turned around and kind of, you know, did a secret 180. Mm-hmm. Where all of a sudden she said, oh no, wait, I think I do want to be in a relationship. Right. And couldn't really tell anybody that she went back on her promise of, I'm going to be single and loving it.
So this brings us to my next question is, you know, we read Adulation, but what else have you written? And where can we buy your books?
I've written 6 books so far. 5 of them are novels. 3 of them are a trilogy. Two novels. Adulation is one of them, is standalone, and then the memoir, which is called Friends of Mine, which is about my 30-year relationship, so to speak, with the band Duran Duran. You can buy them. You can, and I'm gonna give a little plug for independent bookstores. If you go to the store and ask them to order it for you, most of them will. Even a few of them do stock it, but otherwise, Amazon.com. You can go and as far as ebooks are concerned, they're only available on Kindle. So mm-hmm. they're not available on Kobo or anything else.
Mm-hmm. And I will say also that they are available on Audible.
Yes, they are.
And WhisperSync, they are WhisperSync ready as well. I have the Faking It, the Andy Cutrone series. WhisperSync is evil. Because I have them, you know, in Kindle. And then the other night I said, you know, I listened to one of the Audible samples. And I thought, this narrator is really good. So I just went.
Did you like the narrator?
I actually did.
Do you know, it's funny. I wasn't crazy. Now, I'm very biased, of course.
Right,
because
of course.
I hear that story a certain way in my head, and I hear these voices a certain way.
Yeah.
I was not crazy about that reader for Faking It in those books. I loved the reader for While of Singlehood, though.
Now, I don't have that one.
There isn't an Audible for friends of mine yet, and it's, it's on my list. Mm-hmm. I want to... I would be making it recording it myself. So it's hopefully within the next year, I will get that done.
That would be wonderful. Now that brings me to my next question. Have you written any other novels in collaboration with other writers? And if so, why did you decide to collaborate? And how did that go?
My novel, Why I Love Singlehood, was a collaboration with Sarah Gorell, who I've known for a little over 10 years now. And it's funny, we remember this story differently. She says, and she's probably right, that she said, you should write, she knew about the idea that I had for this novel, and she said, you should totally write that. And I said, well, I'm not going to write it unless you do it with me. And my remembrance of it is her saying, that's a really good idea for a novel and I want to do it with you.
Kind of the reverse.
Yeah, exactly. So like I said, she's probably right, but it is funny that we remember it differently.
Right.
But we had collaborated on a couple of things before. She was actually, here's a little secret that I think is starting to make its way to the mainstream. She was my student when I taught at UMass Dartmouth. She was in my English 101 class, and she was still, to this day, I think the most talented writer I ever taught. And I had eventually started mentoring her throughout her undergraduate career. And so we worked together on a couple of independent projects. So we started to really get to know each other. And I started treating her as a peer in terms of the level she was at in terms of writing. So I would give her a draft and I would say, tell me what you think of this. And she, at first, she was very intimidated, like, my teacher is giving me something to comment on, you know, but I really trusted her. And then, so like I said, we started collaborating and I taught her about writing style and things like that. And then we eventually became friends. Which is not usual, you know, that's not common for me that student teacher relationship crosses over into a friendship thing. It has happened a couple of times, but it's not the norm for me. We were writing, we each had kind of like a private blog, and we were reading each other's blogs, and I think we were absorbing each other's writing styles just from reading each other's blogs, so that when this idea for this novel came and we wanted to write together, I think we knew we would be good collaborators because A, we had the same vision for the novel. B, we knew each other's writing process and we knew each other's writing style. And part of that is because I taught her that process. Or she learned it, I should say. You know, she learned my vision of process from being in my class. And And so we just, we worked really, really well together. And we wrote in different states. She was in upstate New York at the time, and I was in North Carolina at the time, and we were just doing everything through email. And this was before we were Skyping, so we were doing Google chats and phones. And then I think we finally got in a room together for 1 week and worked on it that way. I think it took us about 2 years to do it, 2 or 3 years. To get that novel done. But it was great fun. Great, really, really good fun to do it. We were wonderful. She spoiled me because it's hard to find a partner that good.
Right. And which overall sells better, the collaborative novel or the ones that you write solo?
I think the solo stuff has sold better. I don't think it's because it's solo and the other is collaborative. I mean, the best compliment we get on that novel is that it doesn't feel like a collaboration. It feels like it was one person wrote it. But you know, it's an interesting business because there are some days where, you know, that novel sells a little bit more than others, and other times it doesn't sell as well. It's been reviewed pretty nicely. But it took a while. You know, the other interesting thing is with that particular novel, it took a while to catch on. I think it was it for about a year, it got some mixed reviews. And then going into its second year of publication, all of a sudden, people noticed it and were buying it and recommending it to people. And the reviews got positive, and not that they weren't positive before, but we had a mix. And now they're predominantly 4 and 5 star reviews that we get for that one.
Oh, that's wonderful.
So it's good. Yeah.
Yeah. How is Adulation doing as far as reviews are going? Since that's the book we read, I'll speak a little bit about that. Ask you some questions about that book.
It does well. It's believe it or not, it sells the least out of all of my books, which is kind of surprising. At the time that I had written, and again, this goes back to just the way the industry is, where you just don't know what is going to do well and what won't do well. I mean, at the time, my editor said, "This is your best book, and you're gonna blow all your other sales out of the water." And then other readers had said, "I think this is the best thing you've ever written," and it really didn't do well. Now, it could have just been the timing of its release. It was released in 2012. I think it was actually launched on Election Day, so people were a little distracted.
Right.
There was Hurricane Sandy, you know, so there was, and I had just moved, so I didn't put in the promotional energy that I normally do, so it could have been that. It could have just been that people didn't take to it for whatever reasons. It's longer than anything else I've ever written. I think it's at 105,000 words or something, which is a lot for me. For some authors, I should say that's average, or standard. But I think average is more like 75,000 to 80,000 words. So it could be that, but it does, again, it especially recently, it's gotten very favorable reviews. And in fact, one of my very loyal readers and reviewers actually just tweeted about it recently and said, it was very sweet. She said, "I don't know why more people don't know this book or haven't read this book." And she said, "It's the book I most gift to other people." You know, she says, "When I'm going to give somebody a book, I gift them Adulation."
That's
so that
very
really
sweet. How did you come up with the title for the book? Other than I know you use the word a lot in the book, but was there another reason why that title itself was appealing to you?
Yes. That book was inspired by Aaron Sorkin, who, if you don't know, he's a screenwriter who wrote The West Wing and The Social Network and more recently The Newsroom. And at the time, he was on Facebook for a while he was writing The Social Network. And this is during the time when they had those group formats where you can respond individually to people and things. And he was interacting with with the fans on that page. So he talked to me a little bit, talked to some of the others, and I had met him as a result of that. And he had said something on that group page of something like, well, you know, I live for your adulation. And something about that really struck me. And from there, I thought about, he's had an unusual career. You know, in some ways, it really was one of these, I can't say he was an overnight success, but he became successful in a way that most screenwriters do not. And he's a bit of a celebrity. And that was interesting to me too, that here's a writer and a screenwriter at that who is a celebrity as well as a screenwriter. And I thought about, you know, how many Oscar-winning screenwriters would I know, you know, would I bump on the street and know that they were an Oscar-winning screenwriter, as opposed to, you know, if I were to bump into Aaron Sorkin on the street, I'd be like, oh my God, that's Aaron Sorkin. So that's kind of what interested me. And that's kind of where the title came from. So, and that's what inspired the character of Danny Masters. So I don't want to say that I was writing about Aaron Sorkin, but those aspects of his career, and his life, I guess, for lack of a better word, were very interesting to me. And to think about that, and of course, then I wanted to juxtapose that with somebody who didn't want anything to do with the spotlight and didn't want anything to do with celebrityism, and see what happens when these two, you know, and of course that what if is, and what if these are the two that are made for each other? How do they work that out?
Who was your most favorite character in the book?
Georgie.
I have to agree. I think he was mine too. Why was he your favorite?
Georgie was so, he was the first one, well, I think Danny was the first one I had a really good handle on. Georgie just was so, he was so present and so real to me. And I adored him the moment he opened his mouth. I don't know what it was with him. I just absolutely adored him. And he was fun, and he was a great, he was Sonny's conscience in a way, but he also, again, he clearly adored her. And I think the adulation, you know, again, just playing on that word or that title, they had that for each other in a very, very intimate way, those two friends. So I loved that, and I loved seeing that. I think I had a soft spot for Danny, too. I had a lot of compassion for him.
Mm-hmm. Did you have a least favorite character?
It's hard for me to say that, because when you're creating them all, even the ones that are villainous and flawed, you almost get a little protective of them anyway. So I was talking a little bit about Charlene. Just, it's not that she's my least, again, it's hard for me to say that I don't, that I have a least favorite, but I think her flaw, which was what I was saying before, is her fatal flaw is that she's not fatal, but she didn't evolve. She didn't change throughout, and I think that kind of led to her her fate,
right,
at the very end of that book. And she wasn't always very nice. You know, I don't think she realized. You know, she definitely was self-absorbed. But again, I have compassion for all of them, and it's hard to know what she probably wasn't born that way.
Right.
There was probably something in her past that she hadn't, you know, that had kind of brought her to that point where she was really, I'm going to fend for myself, and it's how does this affect me? And I hinted at it a little bit that she didn't feel that anybody paid attention to her, you mm-hmm. know, when she was growing up. And so she kind of seeks it elsewhere now, and she's kind of a junkie for it, that if you're not paying attention to her, she doesn't really have any use for you.
Mm-hmm. I thought you picked a very interesting name for her. How do you choose the names for your characters?
I do have a list of favorite names. and I try not to use them, you know, I try not to be so, and they all kind of have patterns to them. I tend to like words with the IE sound at the end and Danny, Sunny, Andy. And sometimes they'll have a meaning to it. Devin, for example, when I first created that character, I thought of him as very devilish. And so I came up, I wanted something kind of similar to that. But I also knew that, you know, his real name was going to be revealed later on. And when I chose David, I looked up David and the name meant beloved, and I really liked that for him. So mm-hmm. that was where that name came from.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to think of how Danny. Being that book was so Aaron Sorkin inspired. Sorkin has in just about every single one of his works, he's got somebody named Danny. So I kind of did that as a little nod
uh-huh.
to him. I like it's a shame that actually Aaron Sorkin and I have almost identical we like the same names. It stinks because now everybody's going to think it's she's only naming it because Aaron Sorkin did. It's like no, I like that name too.
Okay.
I do try to. There's usually a meaning behind the name. Sometimes it is just purely aesthetic, but sometimes mm-hmm. there's something a little bit more personal
mm-hmm.
for me.
Mm-hmm. If you could change one thing about the novel, what would it be?
With adulation?
Mm-hmm.
If there was a way I could have shortened it, this is in hindsight, I think I would have made it a little, I think it, and maybe I'm wrong, I don't know. I think for some people it was too long. But it was a challenge because it's the only novel so far where I've done two points of view, where I did Danny's point of view and Sunny's point of view. So in a way, it was almost like putting two novels into one. So I had to tell those two stories.
Mm-hmm.
Then again, I asked myself, well, what would you take out? And I can't. I don't know. I would probably have to reread it and say, well, maybe I could have cut that, but I don't know. And I did cut about, I think, 10,000 words from it or something like that. So I did cut off quite a chunk of it. I think that's the main thing. It did turn out a little bit different than what I had originally envisioned it. And not to say that that's a bad thing. It just turned out to be different. I would like to do a sequel for it. I have an idea for it, but I'm not. It's not screaming at me to be done yet. So when it screams at me to do it, then maybe I'll do it. But I have an idea. I'll just say that. So I don't know. I don't want to get anybody's hopes up. But
Do you have any interesting fun facts about the book or its creation? Any interesting things that happened while you were creating it?
While I was creating it,
or publishing it. It doesn't have to be during its creation necessarily.
Yeah.
But
no, I can't. It's funny. I can't think of anything fun for it. Other than to say, you know, it was also again, it was that inspiration of having met Aaron Sorkin, and having a moment, and not to say this was autobiographical or anything, but when the moment I met him, it was funny because I did look at him and say, you know, I could go out on a date with this guy. Like if he was anybody else,
sure.
You know, and not like famous screenwriter, you know, Oscar winner Aaron Sorkin. Mm-hmm. I had that thought, that very, very fleeting thought. And I think that's really where that was kind of the final piece in place of writing that was, what if, you know, what if a seemingly, you know, normal, everyday, hardworking person, you know, is really meant for this person who has become extraordinary. You know, I kind of wanted to play that out in its entirety. So it wasn't my fantasy of saying, "Oh my God, we're really meant for each other." It was that. Well, what if, you know, what if something like that happened, and could that happen in reality? So that's kind of what I wanted to play with that. But other than that, nothing. I can't think of anything interesting or extraordinary that happened during the writing of it, or even the publishing of it.
Going a little bit in a circle here, but what other authors write books that are similar to that book, or just to your books in general, and what makes them similar?
You know, I thought about that question, and the answer is I don't know. I never think about it in terms of who writes like me or who has books similar to me. I'm always trying to think, well, who do I want to be like, you know, who influences me? And I like, and again, I don't think we're similar, but I like Marion Keyes and Nora Ephron is another one. And in fact, I think Adulation is kind of like Sleepless in Seattle in a way.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Which is funny because at the time I hated that movie when it first came out. I did not get it.
One of my favorites.
Yeah. So, joke's on me.
Do you have a different view of the movie now that you've written the book, or do you still hate it?
I don't hate it. There are things about it. Let's put it this way. I know what I didn't like at the time. And there are still some things I think could have been done better. But I don't have the disdain.
Yeah, I can understand the disdain.
Yeah, I don't have the disdain. It's I wouldn't put it in the top three of my favorite Nora Ephron works, but no, I don't have the hatred for it that I did when I was 22 or whenever it came out.
It's one of those weird things with me. I really, really love that movie, but at the same time, I can understand why people hate it.
Yeah.
I can be pulled both ways about the movie, and it depends on my mood. And so I totally understand it.
But now, and here's the other funny thing. I think that the same thing that people didn't like about Sleepless in Seattle are what they don't like about Adulation.
Mm-hmm.
So again, it's, well, I can understand that. And I didn't necessarily plan it that way. But as the story was unfolding, it was, it's not about these two being together. It's about what they're learning while they're apart. That's what the story is. It was the journey rather than the destination, so to speak.
Right.
With that particular book.
Right. And speaking of journeys, when did you decide to become a writer?
I never decided to become one. I always was.
Mm-hmm.
It was something for as long as I've been literate, came very, very natural to me. I don't want to say it came easily, but it was instinctive. I was always doing it in one form or another. I would write I was making up stories for school, writing essays and, you know, doing writing contests or things like that. Submitting them for essay contests, in high school, doing the literary magazine and things. I wrote a lot of bad poetry at that time, which when you're a teenager,
I do know about the bad poetry.
You write the bad poetry. And I did a lot of private writing at that time. I wrote in my diary, and I wrote about this in friends of mine. This I didn't know at the time there was a word for it, but it was fan fiction that I was writing, and so I did a lot of that. So I was always writing. I didn't decide to make it a career until my mid-30s, and even then I didn't think it was as a novelist. I didn't think I was very good at writing fiction, it wasn't until I finally wrote Faking It, and I was surprised that it came out as good as it did, and the dam broke, and all of a sudden it was, I'm a novelist.
Because, you know, like, I remember...
Anybody was more surprised than I was that I was a novelist.
Because I remember when I met you, and even a little bit after I met you, when you introduced yourself to me, it was as a teacher at the university. It was not, I'm a novelist, and I didn't find out you were a novelist. The only reason I found out was because somebody else told me. I was like, really? Right. Oh, yeah. I didn't know that. That's very interesting. And so I thought, wow. And so it just really amazes me how people's, you know, how things have changed for you over the past, you know, 4 or 5 years.
Oh, yeah. Maybe
even, when did we even meet? I don't even remember. 2007 or 8? 6 years, maybe?
At least,
yeah,
something like that. Whenever the book club started, so it had to be around that time. Yeah,
yeah. So, why do you write? Why do you write now, excluding the bad poetry as the teenager?
I write because I can't not do it anymore. I love it so much. I feel the corny answer is I feel like me when I write. It's just like being home, even when it's hard. I just it's the only thing I want to do anymore. And not to say that I don't miss teaching. There are times when I really, really do miss that quite a bit. But I don't want to be in that system anymore of where I have to be grading and doing all, you know, lesson planning and all that stuff. I want to find different outlets, and I am finding different outlets to do it. But I just enjoy it so much, and I have more ideas than I know what to do with right now. So I'm in no danger of running, you know, the well running dry.
So when you decided to start publishing, what made you decide to actually sit down and start something, start your first novel or piece of writing?
Excuse me. My first novel was Faking It. And honestly, I wrote it because the damn thing wouldn't leave me alone until I did. It was, I got the idea with it in my senior year as an undergrad, was when I got the first seeds of the idea for Faking It. And then I went to graduate school, and I was loving all of that. You know, I really found what I wanted to do at that point, which was I wanted to teach writing composition. I wanted to be a writing program director and in a university and get my PhD. I was all set with that. But this idea for this novel always kept whispering to me, and eventually wasn't just an idea anymore. There were voices, and they were talking to each other, and they were revealing things to each other. And finally, I graduated. I got my master's degree, and it was about a year after that. It was 2004, and I said, "This thing is not going to leave me alone until I write it." And I think I started it spring break, and then I finished the first draft over the summer, And lo and behold, that's, like I said, the dam broke, and I had all kinds of novel ideas pouring forth that were just, had just been dormant, and all of a sudden came to life, and I realized I could do this. So I didn't know what to do with this manuscript once I had finished, because I'd been so immersed in academia I didn't know anything about publishing. I didn't know how to get an agent. I didn't know anything about self-publishing. I knew nothing. So I came down to North Carolina with this manuscript, and it wasn't until I met Stacy Cochran, who I said, "So what do you do?" And he said, "Well, I'm a novelist." I'm like, "Oh, cool. Let's talk."
So you write full-time now, I assume?
I do, yeah, I do.
Do you have a special time of day that you write, or how is your day structured?
Very loosely. I tend to be, I say I'm a day person. In other words, I'm not a morning person, and I'm not, even though I stay up pretty late at night, I don't work at night. My peak work time is usually like between 11 and 5 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
And usually, if I'm not too distracted by Facebook and social networking and stuff, I can usually get a lot done in that little bit of time. So even though it sounds like I'm working part-time hours, I actually get a lot done in that mm-hmm. part-time.
Do you aim for a set number of words or pages per day? Or, I mean, when you say you get a lot done, what do you mean by a lot?
Well, it depends what I'm working on. It depends on if I'm in the drafting stage. I actually aim low for my word count. So I'll say something like, I want to get 1,000 words per day, or I want to get 750 words per day. And then usually I exceed that. A really, really good writing day for me is about 5,000 words. Mm-hmm. An average day is probably around 2,500. That's when I'm in the drafting stage. When I'm in the revision stage, it might be, again, depending on how much work that manuscript needs, I don't necessarily go for a set amount of pages per day, but I might just do it by chapter. Okay, I want to get 3 chapters revised today, or 2 chapters revised, mm-hmm. or something like that. So it depends on what I'm working on. Now, right now, I'm not really, I've turned 2 manuscripts over. They're being read right now, so I'm not really working on anything right now. So I'm getting ready to go to New York and do a little bit of research now. So, but there are days, I have to say, there are days sometimes when my day is social networking. That's my work day, where I have to do, I'm promoting things, and I'm in touch with other writers, or I'm doing what you and I are doing right now, and doing interviews or that type of thing, or meetings, having meetings with people and things. Mm-hmm. So sometimes that I'm not physically writing. That's my day.
Mm-hmm. How do you write? In other words, do you like write on the computer, or do you do what some authors do and write on a typewriter or pen and pencil? This may be a silly question, but
no,
some
it's
writers
not.
Actually still use those things.
Oh, yeah, believe me, I know they do. It's not a stupid question at all. I would say 98% of my writing is on my laptop. Once in a while, though, I need that longhand experience. So I have a notebook and I write it out longhand, and then I go back and I copy all that, you know, type it all onto the laptop. I still keep a journal that is just private writing, so it's not anything for novels or anything. It's really like that literal dear diary, you know, here was my day. But yeah, for the most part, it's all on the laptop now, just because it's so, you know, to maneuver everything in terms of copying and pasting and deleting and all that kind of stuff. It's, you know, it just, it helps
yeah.
to work like that.
And do you make a backup copy?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I am obsessive with saving. And in fact, sometimes on Facebook, I'll jump on and I'll do a status update. And then without even thinking, I hit Command S. Because I'm like saving. I'm always in that saving mode. But I save, you know, I have backup files and stuff like that. In fact, I have to re-update all that.
Where do your ideas come from?
Oh, they come when you least expect them to. Sometimes it's just something somebody says, and all of a sudden, the idea is the seed is planted. I never go looking for it. It's never a conscious thing where I sit down and ponder, what am I going to write about today? For example, adulation. It was just that line that Aaron Sorkin wrote on Facebook, which is, you know, I live for your adulation. And that, you know, that's what inspired, you know, that was the seed. That was the first seed, I should say, that was planted mm-hmm. for that novel. And then it kind of sprouts from there into other things.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes it's something I read. Sometimes it's something I see on TV or I observe, or it's in conversation, or it could be anything.
What's the hardest thing about writing?
Sometimes it's starting to write. So even though I have the idea to sit down and actually start doing it, there's always a moment of panic that I'm not going to be able to do it. Sometimes it's when you're in that no man's land in the middle. You have your introduction, you have your ending, but it's getting from A to Z or A to B even is difficult to do.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, sometimes that's the hard part. And it's just, and I know so many authors go through this, just there's self-doubt. And you just have to get around that sometimes, where you just, at one point, you stop and you look at it and you go, is this any good? Or is this all a load of garbage? You know, and maybe I should, you know, dust off my CV and start applying for teaching positions again, you know.
What was the hardest thing about writing adulation?
Oh, that the difficult thing about that was getting those two timelines to align, but not have it so precise, you know, that everything was happening at the exact same time, but I wanted it to follow some kind of logical progression to show that these two lives are, you know, they were parallel, that they were happening. So it wasn't exactly that this is what Sonny's doing at this moment, and this is what Danny's doing at the exact same moment. But right. I wanted to show that while Sonny is plotting away at the bookstore, Danny is going to premieres and is doing this and that and the other thing. And so it was hard to get that lined up and, mm-hmm. and to finally get them where the two of them need to be. In terms of their evolution and their development, mm-hmm. To get them to finally to be where they both need to be. So that was a challenge mm. with that.
So how do you get through the dreaded writer's block? I'm assuming you've probably experienced it.
Yes, I am. And I do, you know, I know there are a bunch of authors who say there's no such thing as writer's block, and I say, tell me that when I'm curled up in a fetal position. I have to psych myself out of it. So sometimes I free write and I just start writing and I start with this, and I have to allow it to be bad, because that's, for me, what's at the heart of my writer's block is a fear that it's not good. And that's not going to be good, and that no matter what I do to it, it's never going to come out the way I want it in my head, or the way it's already in a way it feels finished in my head. And yet for some reason I can't get the finished version out from my head onto the page. It's like it goes someplace else. So that's where the fear is for me. Usually sometimes it's just, I've got this character in a jam and I don't know how to get her out of it. You know, sometimes it's just something as simple as that. So sometimes I free write. And like I said, I just allow it to be bad. I'm not writing well. It'll get better. I can always revise. Nobody's reading this. It could suck as much as it needs to. And I'm actually literally typing that. And then I segue into, here's what I want to do with this scene, or here's what I'm trying to do with this chapter. And so I actually, in the free writing, try to start working it out. And as I do that, sometimes, not all the time, but a lot of the times, I should say, that frees me up. And the idea does come to me, and I do kind of figure it out. It's almost like I'm talking my way through it. through the free writing.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I do that. I talk it out with somebody. And I don't like to talk about my works in progress. So I do that as sparingly as I need to. Sometimes I just put the writing away and I read a lot, or I watch certain TV shows of, you know, my favorite shows that inspire me in one form or another, and get my mind off of it in that way. And ultimately I go back. I just try not to let it go on for too long, because when it goes on for too long, it's harder. It gets even harder to get back into it.
Mm-hmm. So when the book is all done, mm-hmm. Do you proofread or edit your own books, or do you get someone to do it for you?
Now, when I first did Faking It, I did it myself. And part of that was because I didn't have the money to have somebody else look at it. And the other part was, I think I had at the time trusted my abilities to do it, which I no longer do. I'm not as good as I thought I was, which is what I learned. So I do a lot of self-editing. It's not that I don't, but in a professional capacity, it goes through, especially for the publishing process, it goes through several editors. It goes to a development editor who helps me with the content of the manuscript. Then it goes to a copy editor who goes through the grammatical and formatting stuff. And then it goes to a proofreader. And sometimes it goes through several proofreaders. And what I love about my publisher is I'm a team. They treat me like a team player. So it's not that it goes off to all of these people and I never see it again until it's on the shelf, so to speak. I am part of this process from the very beginning. So I get to approve everything that the copywriter does. I get to approve everything that the proofreader does. So ultimately it's on me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's my responsibility. I have the final say.
How did you find the publisher? What was that process like?
They found me, which
and who is the publisher is, again?
Say it again.
Who is the publisher again? Sorry.
I'm published with Lake Union, which is owned by Amazon Publishing, which mm-hmm. is different from the self-publishing Kindle KDP, which is Kindle Direct Platform. This is Amazon Publishing is a publishing company like any other, like Algonquin or you know, Simon & Schuster, any other publishing company. And Lake Union is one of their imprints.
Okay.
They actually found me. And at the time, the imprint was Amazon Encore. And they were finding self-published authors who were successful, not only just by the volume of books that they sold, but they were looking at the quality of the book. So it wasn't just, oh, this person sold, you know, 20,000 units, let's sign them. They were reading these books and were signing people that whose books they really loved. And fortunately, I was one of them, because Faking It started out as self-published,
mm-hmm.
and it did very, very well, and the word of mouth had spread that it was good, and was getting a lot of positive feedback and positive reviews. So my acquisitions editor, his name is Terry, sent me an email, and the email headline was Amazon Encore loves Faking It, and I was almost suspicious, like, oh God, who's trying to scam me? And he raved about it. I loved it. It was smart. It was funny. Great characters, and he just really raved about it and courted me and said we want this and we want you, and then when I talked to him and found out more about what they do, I was like, I'm in.
Mm-hmm.
So I was very, very fortunate, because typically, you know, and I had spent a good year querying literary agents and just wasn't able to get a literary agent. So here it was, somebody came to me and wanted to sign me.
Mm-hmm. So in all this whirlwind of writing and rewriting and revising, how do you relax and take a break from it all?
You know, it's interesting. The two are very interrelated sometimes. Sometimes my work is relaxing. Sometimes when I'm writing, I am relaxed. Other times it's just things like reading, again, just pleasure reading, watching TV. I'm a creature of habit. So if I find something that I like, it's you know, like those binge watchers, like House of Cards or something, and they just go through the entire series. That's me.
I know a few people like that too.
You know, I devour something, and then if I really, really love it, I keep going back to it. Mm-hmm. So I don't discover as many new things as I should probably because I am that way. But the things I love, I just really, really love. I like to hang out at coffee shops, and sometimes I work in them too. You know, I do my writing in the coffee shops, but sometimes I just like to hang out and have fun. When I do get back to Long Island, I just like to spend time with my family. I like to go to the beach. And I'm fortunate where I'm living now in Massachusetts. I literally live around the corner from this little tiny private beach with a nice little bay. And I just go hang out sometimes, and I just sit there and I don't even do anything. I don't bring a book or anything. I just sit there and kind of stare out at the water and just let my mind go.
Do you have any hobbies or talents that are interesting and unique?
I was playing guitar. And actually, I stopped playing, and I'm sorry that I stopped playing. Some of it is just procrastination of I have to change the strings on my guitar. They're terrible. They've really just worn down. And I try to tune in the guitar, and it doesn't stay tuned. But also because I think I got to the point, I taught myself to play, mostly taught myself. My brother showed me a few things. And I got to a point where I was saying, well, I can't do this by myself anymore. I need some lessons. And I just haven't gotten around to taking lessons yet. I'm making an excuse, of course. But I miss playing. I did enjoy that. And also, I think it was when I was living in North Carolina, you know, I lived in an apartment, and I think I was always afraid of playing too loud so that, you know, either the people below me or next door were going to hear me and be like,
shut up.
But I live in a house now, so it's, you know, I should, and I don't think I've picked it up. I can't even remember the last time I picked it up again. It's sad. So I would count that as a hobby. I like to bake, which is a dangerous hobby when you live alone.
Poppy seed muffins.
Yes, poppy seed muffins. And
or was it cake? I can't remember what it was.
Yes, I made recently. It was poppy seed cake I made.
That's what it was. With the day you broke the jar of garlic all over the floor. And
yes. Yeah, I never said I was good. I was good at it.
Oh, no, I'm not making fun of you because it is so something that I would do that I thought it was just the funniest thing.
Well, fun. It's okay. You would be right.
No, if only because I can so see myself doing that same thing that I just thought it was just funny.
The most recent one was the Oreo cookies and cream ice cream I made, which was just absolutely delectable. I can't wait. I'm going to finish it off tonight. So yeah, I enjoy doing that and just taking walks and stuff like that. I would like to do more with music. I really am starting to get into that, and I'm not sure what I want to do. I've toyed with the idea of teaching myself to play the drums. I've been toying with I don't know about taking singing lessons, but doing trying to. Like for example, on my MacBook, I've got GarageBand, and I did try to sit down. I had my brother sit down with me and kind of help me through it, like, well, what if I want to record something through it? And I was trying to do, but I can't, I just can't do what he does. It's like, yeah. I want to do what he's just so good at it. He's such a natural, and he's, you know, and I'm not a songwriter per se. I would want to do cover songs. To take somebody else's song and do an interpretation of it. But I don't have the instrumentation to do it. I would need the musician to say, "Okay, this is what I want you to play," and then have him do that. But that's, you know, kind of hard to do.
And I know you said you liked reading. Who are your favorite authors? Just as some of our listeners, I mean, I know we all love reading who listen to this. So, who are some of
right
your
now,
favorites?
I'm just so into my buddies' work. I've been reading my friend Craig Lancaster. I've been reading all of his stuff. So, 600 Hours of Edward and Edward Adrift. And I'm about to, my next on my list is, it's called The Summer Sun that he wrote. So, I'm getting ready to read that. My friend Rob Cruzy has a series of science fiction comedy novels. Most famous one is the Mercury series, which is about an angel.
How fun!
Who's in charge of the apocalypse?
I love already.
And it is. It's hilarious. And his latest is called Starship Grifters, which was again just very, very funny. Who else? I like Sarah Pekkanen, who again is, she's known as a women's fiction author, but I've read a lot of her stuff. Gosh, I'm drawing a blank. Isn't that funny? Who else have I read? I've just been kind of reading here and there. Right now I'm reading a book called The Pursuit of Cool by Rob Skidmore. And that's a little bit different for me. The kind of book it is, but I'm into it. I'm liking it.
Mm-hmm. Do you prefer ebooks or traditional books?
I'm the type of geek that I write down every book that I've read. I keep lists every year. Mm-hmm. I just write down the title and the author of who I've read. And usually, by the end of the year, it's half and half. I've done half in print, half in ebook. Now, when I used to commute to NC State, for example, I used to listen to a lot more audiobooks. So that's gone down quite a bit. I do maybe one or two audiobooks a year. But so far, just the way it's worked out this year, so far I've done a lot on Kindle. Mm-hmm. I don't know why it's worked out like that, but it has. But certain books, I think, it's about the experience, the reading experience of it. There are some books I think I will have a better print experience with it, and there are some where I think I will have a better ebook experience. Or better reading experience by reading in electronically. And some I just think it doesn't really matter. It's just, it's only available on ebook, or it's cheaper on ebook, so I'll just buy it that way.
Mm-hmm. Which writer particularly inspires you?
Nora Ephron. Absolutely, hands down, she's always inspired me. I miss her dearly. She did it all. She did plays. She did movies. She was a journalist. She wrote novels. She wrote some essays. She was so versatile as a writer, and she was so into the process. And she, and I think this was mostly because of her journalism career. She knew she had an economy of words, and used them really, really well. And she was funny. You know, she was really funny on top of everything else. And she was one of those who was a storyteller. I'm drawn to stories. I talked about this recently. You know, you also talked about hobbies. I'm very interested in screenwriting. I don't think I'm very good at it, and that's mainly because I haven't done enough of it. I haven't read enough screenplays, and I haven't written enough or practiced enough. But I'm very interested in it as its own genre, and I'm interested in the. I learn a lot. I apply a lot of the craft of screenwriting to novel writing. It's really interesting. A lot of I resonate with the storytelling aspects of writing a movie, for example, and I apply that to my novel writing constantly. So there's a lot of screenwriters that influence me as well. Like Aaron Sorkin, for example, mm-hmm. influences me, and Nora Ephron, and just some Amy Sherman Palladino, who did Gilmore Girls. I loved that series. It was great. So I find that for as many novelists that inspire me, a lot of screenwriters inspire me as well, or screenwriting, mm-hmm. maybe not the writer per se, but, a television show like Gilmore Girls, or a television show like The West Wing, or a movie like The King's Speech, or something like that.
Mm-hmm. What is your favorite book?
Do I have one still? For a long time, it was Straight Man by Richard Russo. That might still be my favorite book. I'm trying to do that. If you know you were stranded on a desert island, what
what would you want with you?
What would you want? I'm literally trying to envision that. I would probably want Straight Man. I would want David Sedaris' Me Talk Pretty One Day,
mm-hmm.
and maybe Nora Ephron's Heartburn, which I don't necessarily think is the best thing she's ever done, but I find that I keep going back to it. Something about that book keeps, every time I read it, I get something different out of it, and I appreciate it a little bit more every time I read it. The first time, I'm trying to even remember the first time I read it, it had to be over 10 years ago, and I was like, it's all right. And then I read it, I think it was 2 years ago, reread it, I should say 2 years ago or 3 years ago, and just said, wow, this is a lot better than I thought it was. And then I picked it up again recently, and I didn't read the whole thing. I think I just opened it, ran to a random page, and started reading it. And something about it, there's something about it that constantly draws me to it.
What are your personal ambitions for your career?
Gosh, so many good things have happened already. It was interesting. For a while, I did want to do screenplay adaptation of my own work, not necessarily somebody else's work, but my own. I've since that, it's still an interest, but again, I think it's still more of a hobby at this point, and not as professional as I had once envisioned it to be. There was also a time when I was trying to sell the rights, the movie and television rights to my work, and I've since let up on that. I'm not as interested in doing that as I was a couple of years ago. I just want to keep doing what I'm doing. Really, at this point, I'm just so happy with the way things are going, and I want things to keep selling. I would like more international. Right now, my books are published in German, or I think so far I have three in German. I'd like to get more, not only more published in German, but I'd like them in other languages. I think they would do well in Italian. I think some of the European languages especially. So I would like that. What else? I don't know. That right there is pretty good.
How can readers discover more about you and your work?
Follow me on Twitter. Or Facebook. I have an author page, Elisa Lorello Author. That's a good way to get to know me and to get to know my writing. I also have a website, elisalorello.com.
And you're also Elisa Lorello on Twitter as well, all one word.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes, I am, at Elisa Lorello. Yes, mm-hmm. I should have said that. Thank you. That's probably the main thing. I don't go on Goodreads enough. But once in a while I'll get on Goodreads. And I've been trying to get out and do more readings at libraries. And like I said, I'm doing this record store gig, which I'm really, really looking forward to actually, and doing conferences and things like that.
What can readers who enjoy your work do to make it successful? What can we do?
Tell your friends. Really, you know, it's I have a rather adverse relationship with reviews. They're kind of a necessary thing in publishing. Just for my taste, they've become like currency to authors, and I don't like that we're so dependent on them. But really, I don't like to plug them as much. I don't like to go on to Facebook or Twitter and say, hey, if you like my book, please leave a review. Not that I've never done that. I have, but I hate doing it. It's the one part of my job I just don't like asking people for reviews. If they want to do it, it's great. I hate asking for it, and I hate being beholden to them. I hate that they have that much currency on authors. But it's the reality. So if you do want to post a review, please do. Absolutely. I welcome every single one, regardless of if it's a 1-star or 5-star or whatever it is. I'm grateful that you took the time. Absolutely tell your friends, though, even if you don't do the review. You know, if you have a Twitter account, if you have, you know, Facebook page, whatever your social media is, talk about it. Post a link to the book. I just read this book by Elisa Lorello, and I loved it. And tell what the title is and give a link, to it. Go to your local bookstore and ask for it. Ask them to stock it. Go to your local library and ask them if they have it. If you have a book club, offer it as a book club, as you did. And I will Skype with book clubs. I did one very recently, a couple of weeks ago, for Faking It, for this book club in New Orleans. And it was great. I had a blast.
Oh, that's cool. That's wonderful.
So tell your friends, and that's the main thing. I'm always appreciative, even if you just text your buddy, hey, I'm reading this cool book.
One last question: what was the really obnoxious pop song that you wanted Danny to play as Ella's ringtone? Did you have an idea what that was supposed to be?
No, I didn't, because I don't know. I'm so out of the loop. I think I've become, it's so funny. I even wrote about this in my memoir. I just remember being whatever, 15, 16 years old, and saying to my mother, I am never going to fall in that generation gap. I am always going to like what's in style with music. I don't know a damn thing that's out on the radio right now. And it all sounds, I am that person, that fuddy-duddy of it all sounds the same to me, and it's all, what is that crap you're listening to? I have become that person. I'm not proud of that necessarily, but I have become that person.
I get
or
that.
I like what everybody else hates. I love, everybody is sick of that Pharrell song, Happy. I love that song. Everybody's like, yeah, I kind of hate it, kind of sick of it. And I think it's great. Or Get Lucky. Everybody's sick to death of Get Lucky. And I'm like, yeah, I'm still listening to it once a day. But I didn't have anything that could be, that's where something like that is fill in whatever is obnoxious to you.
Right.
And imagine it could be. And I kind of imagine Danny being the same way. He just doesn't know.
Right.
What's out there, and it all sounds obnoxious to him, because it's not, Gershwin and Brian Wilson and classic rock,
Sure. Absolutely. I just thought maybe you had some kind of idea.
No.
Okay. Well, is there anything else you'd like to add that I haven't included here?
No, you are very, you got it all. It's great. I loved it.
I know it went on like way too long, but
it's great.
I really enjoyed getting together and chatting with you,
and
thank you so much for coming on and doing this with me. We really appreciate it, and I know that our listeners will enjoy it.
Thank you. No, it's my pleasure. Very happy to do it.
And that is Elisa Lorello, everyone. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
To contact the Book Hoarders, send email to bhapodcast@gmail.com. Follow Book Hoarders on Twitter. Call us at 520-81-BOOKS, 520-812-6657. And visit the website at bhapodcast.com.